So the title of my talk is What is the Point? Now we're here to celebrate Parinirvana Day. And organising the day, the question that has come up for me in various ways was, what is the point? Yeah. And the day's programme turned into a series of invitations to explore that. So I'm only going to highlight some landmarks of Parinirvana territory that I found inspiring. And you might find your own ones during the day. First of all, what is the point of Parinirvana Day? Of course, any Buddhist festival day is an opportunity for us to spend time together, practice together, explore the Dharma and remember the Buddha. And the theme of today's festival is the Buddha's Parinirvana, the death of his physical body, and also the time leading up to that death, as it was recorded in the Maha Parinirvana Sutta. How the Buddha spent the months before his death, when he knew with absolute certainty that he would die soon, when he was summing up his teachings again and again and reminding his followers to remember and apply them with persistence and enthusiasm. And also this sutta is really rather full of descriptions and examples of the many, many qualities of compassion and wisdom that come with awakening. Yeah, sort of how the Buddha is and how he relates to others. And celebrating the Buddha's Parinirvana today, we will also explore our own relationship with death. Why would we do that? What's the point of that? After all, turning our minds towards death can easily lead to a different feeling of what's the point. When I think about the fact that everybody dies, that my loved ones will die, and when I think of loved ones who have died, and that I myself inevitably will die at some point, there can arise a gloomy, nihilistic view that's expressed in this question, what's the point? Yeah, that sort of implies that there is no point to death or to life. And I'll come back to that in a little while. Facing death offers opportunities as well. There was this 85-year-old American woman, Nadine Stair, who, when asked how would you have lived your life differently if you had a chance, wrote, "If I had my life to live over, I'd dare to make more mistakes next time. I'd relax. I would limber up. I would be sillier than I have been this trip. I would take fewer things seriously. I would take more chances. I would climb more mountains and swim more rivers. I would eat more ice cream and less beans. I would perhaps have more actual troubles, but I'd have fewer imaginary ones. You see, I am one of those people who has lived sensibly and sanely, hour after hour, day after day. Oh, I have had my moments, and if I had to do it over again, I'd have more of them. In fact, I'd try to have nothing else, just moments, one after another, instead of living so many years ahead of each day. I've been one of those people who never goes anywhere without a thermometer, a hot water bottle, a raincoat and a parachute. If I had to do it again, I would travel lighter than I have. If I had my life to live over, I would start barefoot early in the spring and stay that way later in the fall. I would go to more dances. I would ride more merry-go-rounds. I would pick more daisies." So here, old age and the awareness of having most of one's life lived, awareness of death being around the corner, leads to a reappreciation of what matters. Yeah, what matters to this woman. And for me, this resonates with my own interests in how to be more alive myself and what really matters to me, and my interest in the answers offered by the Buddha's example and teachings. The Buddha's own death, however, is not any old death. It is often said in the scriptures that the Buddha's true nature, his Buddhahood, if you will, is unfathomable. And so, in a way, is his death. It is called Parinirvana, which has been translated as complete nirvana, nirvana after death, final nirvana, and so on. With his aged body dying and nirvana continuing. In other words, the coming together of the Buddha's ultimate freedom from suffering on the one hand, and the inevitable passing of his physical body on the other hand, where impermanence and continuity go hand in hand, as embodied in this very beautiful shrine. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta describes various situations that give us a bit of an idea of what that might be like, to face death with a completely free heart and mind. For instance, aware of death being close, the Buddha did not succumb to illness, but decided to go on for a specific period and specific purpose. The Buddha did not give in to Mara or appeals from his followers to do this or that. He was very clear about what he needed and wanted to do and what he didn't. In particular, he refused to live on physically or through a personalized legacy. He was rather quite serene about letting go completely. So when old age, sickness and death happened to him, the Buddha experienced them from a position of a full awareness, compassion and equanimity. He met death without fear, easing the fears and grief of his followers. For example, at some point quite close to the Buddha's death, his cousin and long-time attendant Ananda was overcome by grief and hid himself away, crying, "I am still but a learner and still have to strive for my own perfection. But alas, my teacher, who was so compassionate and kind towards me, is about to pass away." So Ananda is sad and grief-stricken. He also seems concerned about being left without the teacher because he has not yet realized enlightenment himself. And he would like for the Buddha's compassion towards him to continue. So there's quite a bit of craving here. The Buddha asks for Ananda to be fetched and then says to him, "Enough, Ananda. Do not grieve, do not lament. For have I not taught from the very beginning that with all that is dear and beloved, there must be change, separation, severance. Of that which is born, come into being, compounded and subject to decay, how can one say, may it not come to dissolution? There can be no such state of things, Ananda. Now, for a long time, you have served the Tathagata with loving kindness in deed, word, and thought, graciously, pleasantly, with a whole heart and beyond measure. Great good have you gathered, Ananda. Now you should put forth energy, and soon you too will be free." And then the Buddha goes on rejoicing in all the good Ananda has done and all his good qualities. So here the Buddha reminds Ananda of his key teaching, about the impermanence of all conditioned things. Then he reminds Ananda of how thoroughly Ananda has practiced and for such a long time. And he reminds Ananda to persevere with and have confidence in his path of practice. So in a way, from the point of view of Buddhist teachings, it seems a fairly straightforward matter. The Buddha Shakyamuni is completely aware, completely free. When he died, there was no clinging to an I identity or so-called fixed self. Merely the physical body that had come into being through conception was born, lived, aged, and died. And everyone who follows his example Anyone who follows Ananda and the Buddha's teachings will too soon be free. The more I am aware and free of the suffering caused by distraction, aversion, craving, ignorance and conceit, the more I am free, responding to life with compassion and equanimity. What to do with these ideas, though? Most of the time I understand them just fine intellectually. And then, when there's a significant change in my life, a rupture to the texture of my world, expected or unexpected, my responses to that show me quite clearly that I haven't taken this in fully. I'm upset, bewildered, and often find it rather difficult to adjust. Sometimes, years after a fundamental change, I have moments of forgetting that things have changed, that my friend has died, or that my brother has been ravaged and changed by alcoholism. However much some childhood memories of him insist that they are who he still is, truly, or should be again. And here, making Buddhist teachings more concrete can be a bit hairy. Shouldn't I feel utterly serene and unperturbed whenever a loved one leaves my life? Am I an unsuccessful Buddhist because I feel the loss of loved ones keenly? In a talk about death, Ratna Ghosha some time ago pointed out that it is not possible to not be upset and experience a sense of love when loved ones die. Grief, whatever form it takes, is a natural response. We can accept grief as expression of love and being human. And then, as Buddhists, we tend to focus on celebrating the love of the deceased person, which is one path to becoming bigger than our own emotional response without denying that response. Sometimes, when the death aspect of impermanence hits me in the gut, the memory of my first deeper, gut-wrenching experience with death comes to mind. It wasn't my very first experience. Yeah, my grandparents had already died and I've lived through that. But it was a very, very strong experience. I was in primary school at the time, and one evening I read a novel called The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. The main characters are Carl, a young boy who's bedridden, and his older, much adored and very caring brother, Jonathan. Early into the story, there is a fire, and Jonathan dies as he rescues his little brother, Carl. Carl is devastated, and so was I. Sometime soon, Carl dies from his illness, deeply lonely and grieving. And that also moved me very, very much. This sort of image of someone, a child, dying deeply lonely and grieving. Carl finds himself in a different world where he meets his brother again and they have many adventures. And at the end of the book, Jonathan is fatally injured and Carl decides to face death together with his brother Jonathan. And I faced death with them. Utterly moved, I cried and cried. I was unable to sleep and eventually sought out my parents. I spent that evening, night and some of the following days in one of my parents' arms as the aftershocks of having faced death washed through me. Grateful for their unconditional love, not querying how moved I was from their book. So what to do with death, yeah, this dark edge of impermanence? It's not quite like the changing seasons, is it? And we don't always have parents close by who are happy to hold us with unconditional love. In another situation described in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where Ananda asks the Buddha to give more, the Buddha advises Ananda, be lamps unto yourselves, refuges onto yourselves, seeking no external refuge. With the Dhamma as your lamp, the Dhamma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge. And how Ananda is a bhikkhu lamp unto himself, a refuge unto himself, seeking no external refuge. With the Dhamma as his lamp, the Dhamma as his refuge, seeking no other refuge. When he dwells contemplating the body in the body, earnestly, clearly, comprehending and mindfully. When he dwells contemplating feelings in feelings, the mind in the mind, and mental objects in mental objects, earnestly, clearly comprehending and mindfully, after having overcome desire and sorrow in regard to the world, then truly he is a lamp unto himself, a refuge unto himself, seeking no external refuge. Having the Dhamma as his lamp, the Dhamma as his refuge, seeking no other refuge. In other words, Ananda and everybody present are told to keep practicing the Dharma and knowing themselves while and through practicing. Because the question really is how to practice concretely to become as open-hearted to change, open-hearted to life and death as we can, open-hearted to this mysterious dance of impermanence and continuity. Buddhism offers us a range of practices. When it comes to meditation, for instance, in our own tradition, we tend to start with the mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana. They address two fundamental barriers to being fully alive, present and open-hearted, the barriers of distraction and aversion. And those two practices can carry within them the potential to address the other big barriers to freedom, all in good time. The barriers of craving, ignorance and conceit. However, the mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana, let alone other practices that invite us to turn towards impermanence and death with somewhat less subtlety, can still feel abstract or even turn out unhelpful. You might remember that from your first attempts at the metta bhavana, there were warnings about the so-called enemy state or difficult person state. The warning is to choose somebody you have a bit of a difficulty with, instead of your biggest enemy. And that is because with a too big of a difficulty or difficult person in that state, you might well be swallowed up in ill will, righteousness, judgment, anger, and so on, instead of practicing the experience of metta towards that person. This sort of advice, to know yourself and choose your practice wisely, even the details of your practice, is just as relevant for whenever we decide to turn towards death more blatantly. In one of his early lectures on Parinibbana Day, Sangharajita stresses the importance of being fairly integrated, at peace and happy, before bringing death to mind through a particular practice. In other words, having a fairly steady, effective flow of mindfulness and metta. Otherwise, Sangharajita says, and I quote, "You may start thinking of people near and dear to you who have died, and since your mental state is one of unmindfulness, you may not only feel really sad, but very, very sad, and you might be pulled down into it. You may even start feeling depressed, and this would get in the way of your practice." Of course, it is not the emotional response itself that is unhelpful here, but being pulled down by it while still insisting on thinking about death, falling into a difficult emotion and keeping going with this practice. That's what would be unhelpful. We'd just be torturing ourselves here. So we need to know ourselves, not just once, but ongoingly. We can't just pick and choose practices because they're said to lead to freedom. We need to gauge their effects on us and use the wisdoms of the teachings, our own experiential wisdom and intuition, to constantly adapt, to really dance with the practice. Do I need more self-metta right now? Would it be helpful to come back to the body or breathing for a while? And so on. But why turn towards death at all if it's so difficult? Well, for one thing, like the impermanence of all conditioned things, death is inevitable. We cannot get away from it. So we might as well prepare ourselves as best as we can. In his book, Mindfully Facing Disease and Death, Anālaya argues, from a Buddhist point of view, the existential question that death poses to human beings can be solved in life. In fact, it can only be solved in life. Furthermore, it not only can be solved, it must be solved. So to sum that up again, he says that the existential question that death poses to human beings must be solved, and it can only be solved in life. Why? Why must it be solved? One, to prepare for death and live well the actual moment of death. And two, Anālaya writes, to live a life without the deadening effects of the fear of death. To live a life without the deadening effects of the fear of death. For humans, fear of death is an existential fear. And for the most part, terrorized by this fear, whether we are aware of that directly or not, we turn away from the inevitability of our own death. We invest a lot of energy into that. We push death into a distant future to forget it is inevitable and that it could happen at any time. And much of human sociocultural belief systems, values, and activities are vehicles to distract us from death as we seek security and symbolic immortality in all kinds of places. Those places that Buddhists call false refuges. At the heart of them is this ongoing energy-taking investment in a secure identity and sense of self. And while a lot of us do that quite successfully, it has a strong taste of alienation. And this is the deadening effect that Anālaya calls out. We are not really alive. Anālaya concludes, fear of death is intimately connected with one's holding on to a sense of personality. One who has fully realized the truth of impermanent self thereby goes beyond the fear of death. And the medicine required to cure us from alienation is surprisingly simple. Attending to the possibility that one's own death could happen. Right here, right now. So bringing one's own mortality into present moment awareness. And it does help to take our fears around death and other big fears, as well as our responses to death, very seriously, not in the sense of wallowing in them or allowing them to push us from distraction to distraction, but to find out what we need or want, to be able to really live, to find answers to the question, what is the point of my life? And I want to give just one example that I found particularly moving. Upeksha Raja talking about himself. He's an order member who's also given a talk about death and dying. I don't know him personally. So in this talk, he speaks about a big fear that he's lived his for most of his life, and that is the fear of heights. And he says that at some point after years of practicing, he found out that this fear of heights was in more detail, yeah, more subtlety, was a fear of falling, 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 and then hitting the bottom. And that to him, it was a simile of for his life, yeah, or for life and death, yeah, being thrown into life, and then falling, 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 until hitting the bottom and dying. And Upeksha Raja said that realizing this, what he then found was that what he wanted was to learn to fly before hitting the bottom. Learning to fly before hitting the bottom. So that's a very, very personal journey of turning towards a strong fear, yeah. And it is worth exploring our fears, yeah. Sometimes the strongest ones hide from our day-to-day awareness. Yeah, there might be an underlying fear of madness or a fear of becoming utterly dependent on others. There might be this sort of fear of disfiguration. Yeah, that's also essentially, you know, it's a fear of death. Sometimes they seem rather silly, and yet they tend to point at a particular thread of this existential fear of death in ourselves. And I want to end this talk with the end of Sangharacharya's talk about the meaning of Parinirvana Day. And so I quote him here. "We must try to remember death all the time. In this way, craving can be overcome, and we'll be more energetic, more vigorous, less inclined to waste time, because we realize how precious time is, less attached to material things, more generous. We become more liberal-minded. You hang on to things less. You share with people much more. Then you become less afraid of death, more happy, more carefree. And above all, you develop a better insight into the impermanence of all conditioned things, a better insight into the true nature of existence. So of course, when that will be, we don't know. When we come to die, as die we must, we too shall go to Parinirvana. Or if that isn't possible, at least we shall be going from happiness to greater happiness, from understanding and insight to greater understanding and insight."